with that age, did you look ahead and know that you were an entrepreneur? Like, I know that that was something I knew from pretty much.
If you'd asked my mother or father what they wanted me to do when I was 18, they probably wanted me to go and get a job at a bank, you know, an investment bank, have a salary. But that I now know, you know, it came from a place of they wanted, what they wanted was consistent income and for me to have security. Life didn't work out that way. And
the biggest differentiator in the personality of an entrepreneur versus a non-entrepreneur is propensity for risk. And the second is the ability to handle ambiguous environments.
And I would say ambiguous environments. And then an extension of that is a certain tolerance to pain.
Our guest today is Benjamin Jarrett. He is bridging the gap between institutional trading and motorsport.
A former trader at Trafigura, he specializes in arbitrage and systematic risk. Now he is the founder of RPM, creating the infrastructure and prediction layer that powers the next generation of motorsport fan engagement.
What was the core feeling you were running away from? Was it shame? Was it hopelessness?
You feel remorse, but then you can't. No, I can't deal with that shame. So then you try and hold on to shame, but I can't deal with that either. Or give me drugs. Mm. That's the cycle.
What about if 27-year-old PJ was sitting here in my chair? What would you say to him? Benjamin Jarrett, welcome to The Global Affair.
Thank you. Be here.
It's great that you're finally joining me on The Global Affair.
Long
time coming.
A long time coming, yes.
You've been an audience in my podcast before.
I have.
So you know the format. You know we like to keep it real on TGA and basically try to have the conversations that you wouldn't have on another podcast because that's what my audience are in, so we're going to keep it real, and I know you're all about that. So why don't we start here? How would you define your life philosophy in a couple of sentences?
Good question and good start. I think it's changed. I think my life philosophy now has become really trying to find out who I am, not who I want to be. So I think that we spend a lot of time trying to be all these things because we think we should be them, trying to be the person that we think that we should be, and then not really kind of diving into, well, you know, who am I? And that's not defined by a job or, you know, it's like, who actually am I? What are the qualities that make up Benjamin or BJ or whatever? And that's become, I think I've become through past experience, particularly in the last 18 months, ultra real. I sort of, you know, it's all about kind of, you know, hardcore realism in a way.
Does that make sense? It's the gift in pain, right? Pain sobers you.
It does.
And it helps humble you to a place where maybe you're more willing to just sort of tell it how it is.
And you got to cut out. I think pain makes you cut out all the bullshit pretty quick, you know?
So when we were here before the camera started rolling, we were talking about the themes of identity. I think that this is a really interesting topic, and I think it has many different branches.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to stick with that theme for this episode. And I think in the spirit of identity, why don't you sort of take us back to little Ben and how he kind of related to his identity and how that was shaped through, say, your teenage years and beyond?
Sure. Where did I grow up? I mean, I grew up in the eastern suburbs. I went to Cranbrook. It was a private school. I was there from kindergarten. Interesting part about my story, I mean, you know, my actual first name is BJ, and my name's BJ because I was born, I mean, my mother's here, but I was born, what was it, 3 months premature, 3.5 months? And on the humidity crib, there was Benjamin Jarrett, right? So,
you were 3.5 months preemie.
Yeah, 3 months preemie. I was 1,200 grams when I was born.
Crazy.
Yep. And there's a photo of my father actually holding me in his hand. Clearly, I just really wanted to be in the world. Which is quite common with my intensity. It's funny, I don't really have, in thinking about my childhood was young adolescence, I think, was harder than me. My childhood was actually sort of okay, right? I mean, I was very big into horses. I mean, that was my world, right? I was reserve.
Equestrian?
Yeah, I was a show jumper. I went horse riding 3 times a week, and credit to my parents, really, that was quite expensive, but I think that they did that ultimately to keep me out of what I experienced later in my life. But
go, Mom.
Yeah, correct.
He's in the live studio audience.
Correct. And so, you know, I don't have a lot of, I don't have a lot of, you know, bad memories about my childhood. We moved around a lot. You know, I think that as I've gotten older, there were things that I've uncovered about, you know, your parents stop becoming gods and they become, you know, kind of like equals in human beings.
Imperfect people.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, we're talking about this when my mother's here, but so I don't really think, I don't have bad memories about my childhood. I've discovered over time, and I have compassion for both my mother and my father for things that they might have been going, you know, things that were going on with them. But my memories are, you know, school, horses. My mother would say that the day I turned 17, something switched in my brain. and that was probably very centered around women, but
yeah, you and every other teenage boy.
Correct. It was good. You know, we lived all over the East. We moved around a lot. You know, we traveled heaps.
And when you sort of, with that age, did you look ahead and know that you were an entrepreneur? Like, I know that that was something I knew from pretty much my earliest memories.
It's funny you say that. So my definition of entrepreneur, of what I've actually found out that I like doing in business, whether it's been past businesses that I've set up or RPM or whatever, is I actually quite enjoy structure, like deal making, right? I think there's a talent in that.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you go, if we fast forward and we go into crypto, I like the structural side of crypto. Now that has a different meaning in terms of
the way
of
that it's actually architected.
Trading to me is about the game,
mm-hmm.
right? And money's just a byproduct of that. But did I want to be an entrepreneur? I mean, if you'd asked my mother or father what they wanted me to do when I was 18, they probably wanted me to go and get a job at a bank, you know, an investment bank, have a salary, right? And looking back on that, that was
Eastern Suburbs investment banker. Oh God.
Yeah, can you imagine? But that I now know, you know, it came from a place of what they wanted was consistent income and for me to have security. Life didn't work out that way, and you know, there were times where, like, I mean, I got a scholarship to Bond University.
Could have been friends.
Could have. But we became friends later.
When did you graduate?
2007.
Okay, you're a bit older.
Yeah. So I got, you know, and I could never. And we can label it whatever you want now. There's all these fucking terms, whether it's fucking ADD or ADHD or trauma or this or that. That's, you know, I just couldn't. There was a lot going on in my life, but, you know, when I sort of finished school as a teenager, and I just couldn't really sit in the classroom. But I had a knack instinctively to hang out with a lot of people a lot older than me.
That was an instinct, or did you just get on better with them?
Yeah, I just sort of maybe when I say instinctively, it was like it kept showing up. Do you know what I mean?
That was a pattern, a norm, yeah. Where you found connection and resonance.
Yeah. And maybe looking back now, was I looking for, and particularly older men? That sounded really, really gay.
Not there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, no, there's not, but I'm just more laughing at myself. Maybe because my father was, you know, quite absent during that period. So to sort of circle back, did I want to be an entrepreneur? No, and really, you know, let's define what an entrepreneur is. There's so many different definitions, but
we'll say someone that's sort of blazing their own trail, not working in the structure of a 9-to-5. Like, I know for me, when I was in school and uni, that was my worst nightmare. That was like, you know, the thought of being chained to a desk and being working on someone else's clock was literally one of my biggest fears.
See, what's interesting is that was actually very enticing to me.
So you wanted that security.
I wanted that structure.
Okay.
I
needed the structure.
No, I do. And it's fuck. I mean, whether you ask my girlfriends or people who know me well, or my mother or my brothers, anyone, like, I thrive. I say this often, I'm intelligently boring. Meaning I really quite like the same food. I like eating at the same time. I like when I get out of structure. And we don't, not to go.
You're unhinged enough.
Correct.
Yeah. I get that.
Yeah, bro. Reel
it in.
Yeah. So it was like if I look back on that and I go, okay, I had this block of time, let's say it's banking, I've got this structure. Okay, well, how can I, like, almost get the most out of the structure? But life then turned out that, you know, and as you get older, you become more self-aware, or you look back on parts of yourself and you could, you know, I could say that maybe I was undisciplined. Maybe I was, you know, maybe I could have done things differently and gotten a job at Goldman's or Glencore. And I did actually try for a while. There was a time when I fell into oil trading that I, you know, I went to Switzerland and I applied to a large oil trading firm. And I got into one of their top programs.
In Zurich?
Yeah. No, in Geneva.
Okay. Interesting.
So did I want to be an entrepreneur? No. I don't think that I did, actually. But as life happens.
But you graduated uni, then you went to Europe looking for.
No, I graduated uni and I got into UTS and I went there for a while and hated it. I wouldn't say hated it, but I found it quite boring.
Did you connect with the peers, your peers?
No. And then I sort of found or sort of got leapt into this, you know, this sort of, you know, alcohol, drugs kind of fueled.
At uni?
Well, outside of uni.
Right, but around those years. That was kind of the beginnings of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very big part of my story, and I would say that became very big around 26 or 27.
Well, you actually started to party sort of later on.
I would say that I realized I had a problem with drugs and alcohol when I was 28.
When did the partying start?
When I was 19, I would say.
Wow.
But you have to remember, it was when you're at that age, it's quite acceptable.
Totally, yeah. It's socially encouraged.
Everybody wants to fucking party, right? Mm. And so it's that's how you get out of the connection or whatever.
There's people that want to party, and then there's the people that are partying for 4 days with no sleep.
Exactly. Well, that started later.
Yeah.
And we can get there. But I do remember when, and we lived in Rushcutters Bay, you know, my brother would be going to school, and mum would take him to school, and I'd be coming home, and I'd time when, like, you know, when she wouldn't be there, so I wouldn't get in trouble, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, and so it was just a time of, I guess, looking back, of chaos, that I think that had I'd, you know, gotten into a structured job, etc., you know, and we don't, you know, you've done some work that I've done, you don't really, you know, we don't have regrets, but we often wonder, you know, if you'd taken
how
a
my
different,
life could have gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would it have been different, you know, and to get to the whole alcoholic addict, you know, part. You know, question is, am I born one or did I become one? It's like, well, it doesn't really fucking matter because you are one.
Probably more of a disposition.
Probably. So to answer your question, yeah, I didn't want to become an entrepreneur. I can certainly see, if I take a bird's eye view of my personality and my life, how and why, you know, I you know, my identity fits that kind of mold, if we call it that. But no, I very much wanted the big job, and it was something that my father really, I would say, my mother and father very much wanted for me.
Well, you were talking at the beginning of the conversation about, you know, the shift that's happened in you more recently around, you know, being who you really are, or at least pursuing who you really are versus who you think others want you to be. And when you reflect now, those desires that you had, do you think that was kind of exclusively shaped by what you felt would, I don't know, make your dad proud, or
no? I'd say that probably came later. It was like, I think that was actually.
So, what was the driver of that desire?
Ego.
Just the image of
ego, money, image.
Yeah,
you know, I think there's, as I've gotten older now, you know, fucking hell, I feel fucking old, but I'm almost 40. You know,
are you really?
Yeah, bro, I'm like 37. I'm ancient. I feel ancient.
It's not 40.
I know. That's a bit scary.
Yeah.
That was very charged around, you know, around ego and money and what we think, or what you think money and status, you know. And this is a double-edged sword here, because I have a very different relationship to money now, but I also believe, you know, I mean, the world's fucked around money, but,
A mentor of mine asked me when I was like 19 to draw a picture of money, and I found this exercise.
I wouldn't even know what to draw.
Yeah, so this is going to be my question to you. Just, if you were to draw how you perceive money, how you understand money, just think about it for a second.
Such a complicated question.
Well, and then I'll tell you what.
So loaded, bro. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'll tell you after. I want to know.
Well, no. The first thing that comes to my mind is just greed and just like and like lots of people, like, you know, like yuck. That's the best way I can describe it.
Ugly picture filled.
Yeah, just like ugh. It's just all yucky, right?
Interesting. That's your relationship with money.
Well, no, that's not my relationship with money, but that is how I because I've been involved in certain things where I understand and can see just how much it changes and shapes human behavior.
You know, it's so interesting, because I also used to think this, and the more I walked my path in business, the more I recognize that, and what my belief is, money doesn't change people, it magnifies people. So who you were at the beginning, you know, when you had nothing, is going to be what money puts a magnifying glass over. It's just when you don't have money, it's more subtle. So if you're greedy, if you're manipulative, if you're coercive, if you have a need for control, money just amplifies that. Same if you're generous and collaborative and good-hearted.
Totally. But
it will magnify those qualities.
Yeah, and the reason I'm pausing is because it's such an interesting thing. Like, you know, I think that, you know, let's go down, I think someone with no money, I think there's two parts here. And I definitely agree with you. But let's say that there's a guy called Brandon Novak, okay? And Brandon Novak was rolling with, like, you know, all the Jackass crew. He was the first skateboarder endorsed by Tony Hawk, right? Like, you know, and this guy became a heroin addict at 22, right? And, I mean, his story is, I mean, he would stand on the corner of whatever street and whatever, hoping that the lawyer would get off at 5 o'clock, not 5:30, because he pays him $50 to suck his dick, right? His story is intense. To feed his addiction.
Mm.
And why am I telling you this? Because he didn't have any money. So he started out with money, right? And I would say that prolonged his pain, right? Mm. Because...
like having the access.
Correct. Because what money really buys you is freedom. That's actually what it buys you.
Mm.
And power. That's actually what it buys you, right? And we all want money.
It depends how you define freedom, but...
but no, well, I mean freedom to do things because you want to, not because you have to.
Access.
And then there's the whole access thing too, right? You know? There's that, I mean, you can go on and on in terms of the ISTA club and, you know, in finance. I mean, it goes on, you know, it gets, you know, there's access to, you know...
Trade desks
to cheaper, you know, rates to, it go, you know, visas. You and I were talking about it, right? The golden visa in Dubai.
I think about that all the time. Like, you know, put my visa to the US next to my two passports, next to my soon-to-be Emirates ID, and you just think, wow, you've got global access. And, and you forget the privilege that actually
it's huge.
Gives
and,
you.
And so I was speaking to a friend of mine, actually, and, you know, I've made a lot of money and then lost it all. And I've given a lot of people a lot of money who fucked me over. Money's a very, you know, it's a very interesting topic, but I think it wears many hats. And the reason I tell you that story about Novak is because at a time, you know, I think in my own life when I've had a lot of, and again, it goes down also to, you know, it goes down to your relationship with money. And I think as you evolve, as you grow, as you do work, that changes. But at that time for me, you know, I wonder if I had none, you know, would I have gone, you know, would I have been in more pain, you know, and just had no other option but to go, hey, I've got to go and get sober, or I actually really need help, or I need this, or I need that. Because what money actually buys is that you can hide.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That, yeah.
For a long time.
I mean, this is why gambling addiction is so, like, it's such a crazy addiction when you've seen someone in that. And it's often, you know, the investment bankers, the
Yeah, because you need, yeah. I mean, because, you know, I mean my...
You can't see it.
Well, you have to, you know, that world, investment banking or finance, and when I say finance, I don't mean, you know, but finance is a broad term, but when I'm talking about trading or investment banking or deal makers.
Large volumes of cash.
Huge.
Yeah.
Where your primary job is to make money. That's what a trader is. They don't give a fuck whether you trade the weather, whether you trade crypto, bonds, stocks, equity, doesn't matter. Do you make money? Yes or no. That's it, right? You need to be a certain type of human that can withstand risk.
Yeah.
And
that's actually psychologically, to go back to being an entrepreneur, that is the biggest differentiator in the personality of an entrepreneur versus a non-entrepreneur is propensity for risk. And the second is the ability to handle ambiguous environments.
Ambiguous environments. And then an extension of that is a certain tolerance to pain.
Just being that mad.
Fuck me dead. Right? So to go, you know, traders are, they can handle that. So then you go into, you know, as we've talked about, you know, most of them do. There's a problem with alcohol or a problem with drugs or.
So what do you see, just for the audience's sake, what is the correlation that you sort of draw? Because I agree with you, but from your perspective, that sort of inextricable link where you find a lot of those addictions follow that kind of profession.
Yeah, because of and this is what I was about to say. I think there's two archetypes, And the latter, I would say, is probably the more successful one. And I think if we go back to the identity question, which is where my identity or my, you know, and this is sort of post me leaving, you know, ones or eight, but my identity is like, well, who I want to be and who I think I am. And I know that this is a long-winded answer. I think the first archetype is very egotistical, can handle huge amounts of risk. You know, the guys that make their P&L on, you know, two or three trades, right? And there's a certain talent in that, yeah, where most of them are nothing, but then they'll have a 50, 100, 200 to 1 win, right? And there is a talent to that. I mean, short sellers are a bit like that. They get into data and they want to be wrong. And, you know, they want to show everyone that they are right. Mm. And that this company's dog shit, and that they're going to make a lot of money on the short side, right? Now, bear in mind, if you're short a market, there is no floor, right? So the price can go from zero to a gazillion, right? So there is that sort of archetype. Then there is the second type, who are unbelievably risk oriented, super disciplined, because you have to remember, not trading is trading, not trading is actually trading.
Sure.
But if we talk about
you're equally as defined by the choices you don't make.
Yeah, and they'll say this often, the hardest thing for a trader to do is sit on his or her hands, right? Because you think that I'm a trader, I've got to trade, right? And I've spoken, it is correlated upon any trader, chop, right? Or over trading. That's the worst thing you can do because you're intensifying risk. Every time you're putting a trade on, you are taking risk, right? So I think that if we go to the former, they are people who like pushing limits, right? And if we get into addiction or alcoholism and what it actually, you know, what it is or what it means, there's a level of, I think it's the former that can push certain limits, you know, and if you look at, you know, the definition ultimately of an addict or an alcoholic is defined by someone who has a particular behavior that causes them negative consequences. And behavior, I mean anything, drinking, drugs, gambling, sex, food, fucking overeating, shopping, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, needing to chase some level of extreme.
Just needing to chase something, level of extreme. Feeling. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You and I have talked about this a lot. That suffers them negative consequences that when they would like to stop, they can't. And so then the loop goes around.
Mm.
It is also defined by someone who's been through alcoholism as addiction as this thing. Whatever I'm doing, this thing is going to change how I feel, right? Mm. It is an
external pursuit.
Correct. Mm. It is a very human thing, alcoholism and addiction, because it is the most selfish thing you can do and at the same time the most selfless because you are soothing you. And it can be anything. Now, we can define that as trauma or whatever. And so to answer the question, like, I mean, I speak to normal friends of mine who aren't traders, right? Or even very successful friends of mine who invest.
I was about to say, how much crossover do you see in the personality of, say, like, investors kind of on high-risk venture side? And then
they're so different.
And then even, you know, a startup founder who's also, you know, has that profile to a T in sort of applied in different ways.
I think investors and traders are very,
different
very,
beast.
They're extremely different.
There's still, you know, usually high tolerance of risk.
Yeah. But what I have found and what I will say is that the people that the former, the ego, the sort of I can take risk or whatever, if they can get that under control and combine it with discipline, they're fucking unstoppable.
Mm.
That's like, in my experience, and even with my own life, that is dynamite.
Emphasized in that industry, but it's true for all humans, right? As soon as you reach a place where you're no longer driven by your emotions in an uncontrollable way, and you can actually harness those emotions and direct those emotions, like that's when you cross the threshold to actually becoming a conscious creator of your reality, right? It's by design rather than feeling like your emotions are straddling you and you're at the mercy of them.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm at this weird, I agree, and I'm at this weird place in life. Like life is sort of like, it's kind of cheesy, but it's like life is suffering, actually. I mean, bad shit happens to everybody. I mean, we'll talk about it before, you know, a friend of mine went to prison for 10 years, or then you go down to everybody's got their own shit, right? And you've got to be willing to take the punches. If you can do that, and I think, you know, where I've certainly, I'm not going to say failed because I don't think I've failed, but where I've certainly gotten lost is it becoming too much for my system, reaching for something outside of me, whether it's a bottle or, you know, a substance or a girl or a status or whatever, and hoping that that's going to make me feel better because I can't handle what is currently playing out. Do you know what I mean?
Inside you.
Inside me somewhere. Yep.
So then if we go back to, you know, that time in your life where that was really, you were being driven from that place, really feeling like, you know, you wanted to be the shit,
the hero,
you know, in investment banking or whatever it was. What was going on for you inside? How were you actually feeling about you? Did you even have the capacity to do that self-reflection at that point in your life?
No, it's funny. I think that like my, you want to talk about the sort of deeper inside workings or the stuff inside me. It came much later. I was quite good back then. It came much later. Now, you know, I think that there's also an element to what happened inside my family that we were just doing the best to survive. You know, that's another thing. I think sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. And that's not to say that we never did anything wrong, but I don't remember it being, and I don't think it was a disassociation because I wasn't there yet. I don't remember it being a problem. Like I don't remember that being like, you know, when you notice something, you go, oh, fuck, that's weird. Mm. Like I don't remember it then being a thing.
What, like 1920?
Yeah, 1920, 21, 21.
So you feel like you were just sort of, you know, partying, kind of just not just really thinking whatever, about things, and what, it just was
like,
whatever.
Okay. I was like, who's the next hot chick that I can try and hook up with? Like,
but you didn't get these jobs. So what, like, when did you?
Well, I didn't get the jobs because I wasn't structured enough. But looking back on it.
But you were doing something with your time. So what
was I was entrepreneurial. I mean, I was trading.
You started trading at that time.
Yeah. That's how I learned. I had a job. I shared this on my last podcast. The only job that I've ever had, I was selling plastic, like, fuck, I don't even remember what the fuck it was called. I was selling like the Piermont studio. I was selling like
fluorescent signs.
Yeah, that kind of things.
Yeah.
That was the only job that I've ever had.
They were the shit 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were mad. And then my dad employed me, and I worked with him for a number of years, and I credit a lot to that actually, like when I was young. So if you want to go back.
What was the family? What was his business?
So dad, my father, he started working for a company, or he bought a company called Artes Studios. Which was what we would now sort of define as like a, you know, it's very common. It was a shop and shop. So it was, you know, it was the first sort of furniture company that was in furniture, first design, high-end designer, you know, homeware store that would house different brands, you know, and I'm talking like the Ferraris and Porsches, right? So Bimbi Italia, Cassina, Patrona Frau, blah, 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 blah. Mm. I think he bought it off his partner or something. I don't remember. And then that became what we now know today as Space Furniture.
Mm.
And
were you doing sales for him at that time?
No. So mum had sort of like very gently, you know, kicked me in the bum to like go and spend some time overseas in Dubai, I think as a way to be like, oh, this is getting a bit out of control. He's a bit of a mess. Like go and spend some time with your dad.
They don't drink over there.
That's good. Don't drink over there, which is all that I did. But at the same time, it was great because, you know, dad did do a lot, you know, where we spent a lot of time in Europe and in London and in Milan, and he would put me in these, you know, kind of extreme business situations, you know, with these companies. So he was doing, you know, and this was a time when he left space. So he left space and he went over to the UAE to become the sort of regional director of one of the furniture brands, Bimbi Italia, who does all the, they have a hotel division. So they have like a turnkey division, right? And they build hotels. So they do all the Mandarin Orientals in Europe. They do the Bulgari hotels, cool. Blah, blah, big stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he sort of put me in that to kind of get like a lot of, you know, a lot of experience.
Because you guys were supplying furniture to them.
Well, he was working for them.
Yeah, okay.
It's funny, you know, I was thinking something about my father this morning. My father's actually always been right. He's just been very early.
Mm.
And that's just something I wanted to say to myself. But so, you know, why I say that is because if you look at now the sort of trend is everyone's kind of going, oh, well, do we really need to go to uni? Is an experience better?
Mm.
And dad kind of just naturally did that, right? And so, I was very lucky because he put me in a lot of, you know, he just was like, go work it out.
Mm.
He was quite hard like that, but he was also coming from a place of, you know, looking
be
back on
person.
It. Yeah, but looking back at what I think, he was subtly saying, I actually believe in you, I trust in you, you can do this, go. Now, my younger brother didn't have that. And so if you look at the difference between the two of us, it's sort of, it kind of played out. Like, it is playing out. But what that also did as a young boy, you know, or as a young man, was I can do whatever the fuck I want and I'm good at it.
Like that's what you internalize,
yeah.
and that's what you believe.
I can do anything.
Mm.
Which later in life became a problem.
Mm.
And God, nature, whatever you want to call it, went, no, you can't.
Yeah, there'll always be a bit of a self-correction with the belief.
Yeah,
like
a big self-correction.
But, you know, when you look at like the psychological development of boys to men, the biggest psychological shift that's meant to happen is a boy thinks I am the entire universe, and a man knows that he's a part of the universe,
yes,
and has a responsibility to serve,
yes,
the community beyond him.
Yeah.
Whether that happens at 15, 25, 50, at the end of life, at some point, that chasm has to be crossed.
And, you know, and then you've got, I mean, fuck, I think about it all the time. I mean, then you've got a whole bunch of, now the whole, you know, taking testosterone is a big thing and, you know, everyone's on gear and, you know, yada, yada, yada. I mean, it's like really what you're doing is you're basically just going back to being 18.
Mm, yeah.
Because hormone and psychologically, that's, you pump it up. I mean, I went through a time when I was taking heaps of tests. I mean, and you don't realize how mad you are until you get off it. it's intense. So,
but then, like, testosterone levels are historically low, like, you know, for the first time. And
yeah, but my point is just that,
yes, I agree,
that's psychological. Yeah. And I'm thinking of a friend of mine who's much older than me, but that psychological, you know, with hormones and stuff, you know, the evolution of us as humans or whatever, trying all this shit. It's, yeah, it's so you live in that sort of
HRT is like, yeah, chasing youth forever.
For real.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, you get stuck in that thing. But so for me, it was, you know, I kind of just, I mucked around, I traded. And
who taught you to trade?
Me.
You just were interested. You wanted something to make money. And that's what you saw as.
Yeah, I mean, look, could you say maybe, and this is not me being like, you know, a daddy thing, but like, could you say that my father really wanted me to be an investment banker? Maybe. Did I unconsciously go down that to maybe be like, oh, look, Dad, I'm doing what you say? I mean, maybe, but I was always very interested in that archetype, you know? It's very different now, by the way, because the whole Wolf of Wall Street stuff's over.
because
then you become a liability and we've got this whole, you know, left sort of woke. Like, I mean, it's just over. Like, you know, it's just over. So, so that to me was a very big thing. But no, yeah, I did. I taught myself how to trade, and I remember going. I remember I opened up my first demo account. I think it was with ANZ. I was trying to trade FX. I was like, I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing. And I paid for a bunch of courses, and I read every book, and I failed over and over and over again, and I traded demo for like 5 years.
What was your beginnings like when you opened your first trade account? Were you like, all right, I'm gonna try with $5,000 and see how I
go? So you can actually you can open up like a simulation account. So they call it demo trading, right? So it's exactly the same. It's just the money's not real.
Just to practice.
Yeah, the money's not real. I still do it to this day. If I test new strategies, whatever, I have a demo account running all the time. I mean, actually, if you're on to Bybit, right? Because I know you're with Bybit. Like they have one. So I put, I think, 100 grand in there in fake money, and I traded.
Were there any trades where you're like, man, I wish that had been real money?
Yeah, there was a year. Yeah. There was this year, actually, after I learned to meditate and went broke, the sort of first time I kept trading through this demo account. I mean, I made like 600%.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Okay, so that was all sort of happening simultaneously. You were trading, you were in Dubai.
Yeah, trading sort of in Dubai. No, the training came after. I was in Dubai, you know, crazy, crazy, crazy.
And how old were you at that, like 20?
21, 22, 23. Okay. And I was dating a girl at the time who lived in London. She was an Aussie. And we sort of fucked off and we went and lived in Italy for a while. And we did that thing. And I was working for Dad. I was getting paid like 2,000 euros a month or something. And Dubai was not, you know, what it was. I mean, I'm going there next week. But so I'm interested to see. I haven't been there in, I think, 15 years. But
really?
Yeah, I haven't been back since. Yeah.
All of Dubai, like right now, was built in the last 10 years. It's crazy.
I haven't been there. So, yeah. I mean, I was there at a time where, literally on Shakeside Road, you'd have Dubai Marina.
Crazy.
You'd have, you'd have like Grosvenor House, Dubai Marina, you'd have Le Meridian, Alcazar, Burj, and then that was it until you went to DOFC.
Crazy.
Like, that was it.
You're not going to know it.
Yeah, no, that's what someone said to me. So in there, trading, and came back to Sydney, and then I met a guy who was an oil trader. He was a physical oil trader, which started a big pursuit to try and get into commodities. And but again, ultimately, for the same reasons that I look back now, for the same reasons that I wanted to be in IB, which was because I liked the archetype. I liked that sort of, you know, bigger than that real kind of like bigger than life.
Larger than life guy.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, the ability to just be working towards giant upside.
In anything.
Yeah. Okay.
Fucking everything, mate.
Yeah.
Like everything. Which
yeah.
I've actually learned over time. Is a part of me, but it's actually not me. I quite like very simple things.
Mm.
So yeah, did that.
It could be that that's just been important for your healing.
I think, or maybe. Yeah. That's like a God thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, God's just going, hey, bro, you need to chill.
Just
chill.
Learn to appreciate the mundane.
Yeah. So I did that for ages, raised a whole, then, you know, let's just fast forward, then raised a whole bunch of money into an all trading business, physical.
How? Like you met people that wanted, that you, they wanted you to trade for them?
And yeah, I'll give credit where it's due. I met a guy called Alan Linz.
Mm-hmm.
So Alan is a big property developer. I met him when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
He has invested in all my businesses, to his credit, and backed me, you know, huge. He's been a huge, huge supporter of mine. And so I met Alan in 21 or 22, and we just started talking and formed a relationship, and he gave me a desk at his office. And he was just so happened to be investing in another guy who was trying to, you know, well, it's actually, you know, there's a lot of these stuff that are scams, but trying to sort of sell barrels from one country to another because, you know, if you look at Vitol or Glencore or Trafigura, I mean, the balance sheets are insane. You know, I mean, Vitol now, I think, controls something like 25% of the world's oil. Like it's insane. And so he used to say to me, I like to back people with PhDs, poor, hungry and driven. And I fit that archetype.
I asked a table of investors what they think has contributed to any of the unicorns I've ever known, and their answer was childhood trauma.
Yeah, for real. Yeah.
fucking what an mess. Answer.
So then did all that, and then got really close. And I actually did. I did a couple of physical oil trades. I bought some barrels from Trafigura and I sold them into BP. And you know, I did it, and I signed a big, you know, I signed a credit facility with Macquarie out of Singapore. And you know, and then, but it's a very, very high volume, you know, low margin business, and it's controlled by the big trading houses, and they've got hundreds of billions of dollars on their balance sheet, and it's very
competing against that.
Yeah, or you need to be, you know, gangster and really go into, you know, Russia and pay people, and it's a dirty. I'm actually of the belief. You want to go back to money? I think our whole economy is controlled by oil. I think this is all about oil. That's actually what I think it is. It's because
I think that's pretty widely accepted. No?
Yeah. So anyway, so I did that.
Resources, at least.
Yeah.
As a general.
Yeah, and so I sort of categorize my life now into sort of like three parts, I guess. I've got that sort of like early like 20s, you know, kind of oil trading kind of thing, which I guess was my education, if you want to call, into like, you know, derivatives trading or perps trading. So I did that, went broke. Oh my God, what am I going to do? And then I went to.
So was it a single deal that made you broke?
No,
we should skip over that.
I just couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't.
What do you think of self sabotage?
Maybe I never looked at it like that, but maybe. But I was. I tried the physical or to start my own physical. By the way, I don't believe.
Did you go broke because you had capital under management and then you lost it all? Or
yeah, I went. So when I say I went broke, as in, I had no money, but I'd raised a bunch of money to put into, you know, what, like a physical oil company.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't raised that much, to be honest. I mean, it was maybe a buck and a half, like 1.5 million bucks, right? And then that wasn't working, and it was also a function of I was surrounded by, and I'm not having a dig at sort of Alan or anyone. I mean, they're property guys, right?
Mm.
And, you know, there's an old saying, never trade via consensus, right? Like oil trade is also, it's like, it's quick, sharp. And you know this because you're in crypto, right? The market moves, right? Property is a very slow game.
Yeah. And then the yield expectation.
Correct.
Is very
like we're going to option the site. And we've got time.
Like property people that try to go into venture. It's the worst combination.
It's fine. So I sort of did that. Then I got my first real kick up the ass as a derivatives trader and what leverage means. And I blew my book up. And, you know, and I just went, yeah, I've dumped it all. And, you know, I lost I think it was 200 grand or 250 grand. I mean, it wasn't a lot of
money.
Other
people's.
Yeah.
This was your investment.
Yeah. So yeah. this was before. So blew it up. And then I just, then I went, I hit fuck it mode and I just went like full turbo in partying and drinking. And
well, that's when your path to sort of addiction started to really accelerate.
Yeah. That's when I really understood.
Because it hit you so hard, or you just like purpose, or like, how did you do?
What the fuck am I going to do? Like, what am I going to do?
With your life?
Yeah, what am I going to do? Again, this is why I find identity it's almost so interesting, because it's all come down to that, which is why actually RPM to me is so interesting, because of what it represents to me, right? So we're like, what the fuck am I going to do? And I was with a buddy of mine on a bender. Tell me if you don't know you have a problem. And I remember we're at this house and this chick walks in and we're all bumping rails and we're all fucked up. And she goes, and she's got this bag, like this like backpack, right? And I'm like, you know, we're all there and we're doing gear and whatever, and it's fucking 8 o'clock in the morning or something ridiculous. And I'm like, why? What's with the backpack? Like, are you a stripper? Are you a pro? Like, what's going on, right? She goes, no. I'm going. I'm about to go to rehab. I was like, so hang on a second.
Had she been partying with you all night? Or?
No, she just rocked up. She was out.
Made the decision.
Yeah, like. She was out, and some random chick's coming. She's like going to rehab. And I look at my mate. I was like, fucking hell, mate. This is this is a mirror. Oh, holy shit. Like, this is crazy.
Well, you took it as a sign.
Yeah. And I didn't stop, whatever. And then I'd had periods of really long-term sobriety actually in between all this, like 2 or 3 years.
But what was the core feeling you were running away from? Was it shame? Was it hopelessness? Was it, can you place it?
Yeah, maybe it was a combination of all of that. I think it was like, or maybe it was also like nervous system overload. Like,
it's you're
like,
just trying to regulate yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that I used to think that I wasn't a very functioning alcoholic. I have now learned that I'm highly functioning, like ridiculous. So I think I race and tune cars. It was like a blow off valve. It was like you push the button, like steam comes out. Oh, cool.
And could you ever just have one drink, or were you always the kind of person? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. There's been periods of that. I've explored all of it. There's been periods of that.
And sort of same with substances. Like there are periods where you
alcohol is worse. Alcohol is worse to me than drugs, definitely.
And more-ish, as in more-ish, yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. Drugs is not like drugs is sort of, you know, it was sort of like a. There was this saying that you hear a lot. You know, I could drink or do any drug. But the one that I couldn't not have is alcohol. You think about it. At the end of any night, the one thing that I went searching for was booze.
Mm.
And it's the first thing that started it all, right? So there was that. And for me, it was this blow-off valve. It was this pressure gauge.
Mm. And was this like, this a daily reality for you? Was it weekend?
No, it wasn't.
Was it like Friday to Sunday?
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it wasn't even big. Sometimes it'd be like you go out and you come home at 3 and then you go, oh, hang on, maybe I don't have a problem. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was, you know.
But was it starting to erode your life?
No, it never. Oh, sorry, yes. Before I learned to meditate, it was the spotlight very much, I think, was.
You were living for that.
Was on my, the behavioral change that I would get if you give me enough substances. You know, the infidelities, the this, the that, da 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 da. Like, I definitely wanted, and what I would do to people around me.
Was in your sober state not something that you wanted to do?
Not something that I would ever do.
And were you in that cycle kind of consciously when you were going through that, like you would sober up and you'd sort of feel the remorse, or was it a whole chapter where?
Well, I think, I think also then you. Yeah, this is where it's a spiral, because you feel this sort of remorse when you're in active addiction. I don't think actually exists. I mean,
this is my curiosity. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you feel remorse,
and you're just trying to run further and further away from.
Well,
it.
Well, because you feel remorse, but then you can't. You've
deal
done.
With it.
No, I can't deal with that shame. So then you try and hold on to shame, but I can't deal with that either. Well, give me booze or give me drugs.
Mm.
So that's the cycle.
How much, like, through your journey do you feel, like, identified with the label of an addict? Like, do you feel fully identified with that as an aspect of who you are, even though maybe that's not something that is sort of active in your behavior now. You know how people, they go through all 12 steps, which, you know, I'd be curious to ask you about.
Yeah, I've done that.
And they will say even 50 years sober or clean or having abstained from whatever addiction, I'm still an addict. Like they identify with that.
Yeah, yeah. But look, and that's very 12-steppy, and there's a reason why they do that. So, and I know what you're asking. Do you ever sort of break free from the identity?
But your experience in that.
So, it's really interesting. I'll tell you why. There was, you know, so Ozempic, Mounjaro, and all these new medications. Something that they are testing quite, or that they are investigating,
is stabilization of blood sugar addiction.
On addiction. No,
that's
seriously.
So interesting.
Yeah. So particularly with you know with you know Mounjaro, right? And I started very very early in the pieces when it just came out. I played with that because I wanted to see what it would do to
what happened if your blood sugar was stable.
Yeah. No. And no. But on the addiction side, right?
Yeah.
And this is where I think this identity is very interesting. So I went through this period where I could drink 10 fucking 5 whatever and be normal. I wouldn't have that shift or like
when you were taking Mounjaro, could you drink the yeah, same
but,
amount?
No, yeah, but you just was like I'd have 2 or 1 or it's like the if you walk into any
because it fully puts you off sugar, right? So I'm just curious, like did it actually put you off alcohol? It
didn't put me off alcohol, but I didn't get the give me more.
Right.
I could just drink high volume and I'd be normal.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, interesting.
And so
I'd still drink, but you wouldn't have the effect.
Yeah. Oh, no, I get drunk, but I just wouldn't have the, you know, the like.
I need to take this to the absolute extreme.
And by the way, and there were some nights where I did, but that was more a function of like with friends or whatever. It was more like it gave me what, you know, it gave me choice.
Yeah. It wasn't like this entity driving you.
Right.
Mm.
But I still couldn't have 1 or 2. And it was almost worse because I felt like trapped in this, like, because I knew that the higher self of me, right, shouldn't be doing this at all. Does that make sense? What I'm saying?
So you actually had the awareness through this experience that there was a more conscious part of you and a higher path.
Yep. It was almost worse. I got what everybody in a 12-step means wants. Oh my God, I want to drink normally. I got it. And it was almost worse. It felt worse. Does that make any sense?
I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like when you're sort of in this boom bust or whatever, and I think the reason why the AA tradition, you know, is that they will say that you have defense against the first drink, but you don't have defense against taking the second. So if you can
once you enter the gateway,
correct,
yeah.
So the whole thing with step one is I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable.
Was it your doctor that gave you the GPL to like deal with alcohol addiction, Mounjaro?
Yes, it was him, but it was bred from
that would have been very experimental back in the day.
Yeah, it was bred from because I was training heaps and I wanted to shred.
Mm.
Right? And I said to him, oh, there's this bodybuilder that told me to take thyroid medication. Right? That's what a lot of them do. You pump your thyroid, then you lose weight and then you'll shred.
Mm-hmm.
But very, very bad for your hormones.
Yeah.
Very bad.
Your overall.
Yeah, fuck. System, and so he said, no, he said, don't do that. He said, just go on a really low dose of Mounjaro. There's no bad side effects and it's going to help. It was like a throwaway. It's going to help you with your, you know, with your addiction or your problems with alcoholism. And
so he actually did draw that correlation.
Yeah. Yep.
And the scientific reasoning is because your blood sugar is stable.
I don't know why what the science is behind it.
It must be. It's really interesting.
Go look it up.
When people's insulin is all over the place, they are more erratic. Mood wise,
yeah, yeah,
like it is a mood stabilizer, yeah.
And so, yeah, so then that was that. But so if you get back to the question that you know that you're asking, I think it's the 12 steps will say that you have defense over not taking the first drink, and there is a whole bunch of things that you can do to not take the first drink, right?
When did you put yourself into? Was it AA?
I went to my first NA meeting when I was 20.
And was this okay? Wow, so
like 22 before, maybe.
So even before you really had,
yeah, before what it was before define, I wanted it to. I mean,
well,
I remember
it must have been a problem.
It was. I wouldn't. It wasn't. Look, I defined it as a problem. There were like 3 stages for me. If you want to talk about alcoholism, it was a problem back then because it was like I like because you think you shouldn't be doing it. Do you know what I mean? It's like good, healthy people don't, and they don't. But like, you want to be this high achiever where you can't be having benders every weekend. So I was like, oh, fuck, hang on a second. I can't. I don't know who to talk to, right? I'll go to this thing called NA, right? And I walked in.
But you must have been aware that you couldn't stop yourself in order to do that.
I thought it, but back then I thought it was about gear because alcohol is socially acceptable. So I thought it was about the gear, not the booze, because I wanted to still drink because booze is also at the base of any.
And gear fuels cocaine.
Gear, yeah. I never did. Thankfully, I never did ice. I think I snorted ice once, but I never did ice, and I never did heroin ever, apart from, you know, we talked about this, apart from Oxycontins and, you know, Tramadols and stuff like that. But, yeah, it was mainly cocaine. I mean, I've done pills and everything and acid and all that sort of stuff, but the two that went together was alcohol and cocaine.
Mm.
And so I walked into that's just funny, just remembering this. Like, AA now has become quite young. It's quite interesting. There's a lot of young people in there. Anyway, I walked into an NA meeting. It was in this church and it's dark and dingy, all fucking smoking. And they're like, oh, I can't stop shooting heroin. I was like, what the fuck am I doing here? Right? And I walked out.
You didn't say?
No.
Did you listen to anyone's story?
I was too shocked.
Freaked out by the situation.
Yeah. And they also do this thing in NA, which, look, some people love, some people don't, some people don't like. I personally don't think it's a good thing where when you're halfway through the meeting, they make you go around the circle and ID. So they go, you would say, hi, I'm Nicole, I'm an addict and I'm, you know, 2 years clean. And you'd say, hi, I'm BJ, I'm an addict and I'm one day.
So they just sort of, it's this pattern of reinforcing.
Well, the message behind it is that they want to know if there's any newcomers so that they can help them and they can pass on, you know, pass a hand or do something.
Did you have a sponsor?
Yeah, I've done it all, bro. We'll get there.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is I found later on, as someone who has, you know, I would be considered someone who has relapsed a lot, that there's a lot of shame in that.
Yeah.
If you've just come off a fucking bender and you're kind of going to want to go sneak back into the rooms to try and get help, if you've got a spotlight and you've been 5 months, 6 months, 2 years.
And you're one day.
And you're one day again. But that kept me away from the rooms for years. Years. Because that I couldn't.
So that's kind of your challenge with it, that if someone is grappling their own shame that much, it sort of prevents them from.
Yeah, and you want it, because sometimes, I have had periods of.
It's interesting.
You know, my recovery is, I've had periods of heaps of different pockets of recovery, right? Mm. But it's. You know, sometimes you just, I mean, what I like to do, you know, now is I want to go there and just listen. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to be on the, I kind of want, you want it to be this sort of safe space. And I think there's a crew out of LA, I think they're starting like three A's or three recovery where they don't do that. It's just, they just sort of, it's a bit like, you know, there's also smart recovery too. They don't sort of
it's
ask.
It's more like an open circle.
Yeah, kind of just I'm sharing my experience and.
Yeah,
you know, that sort of stuff.
I'd be so interested to see how they kind of perform next to each other.
But I would say that, and I've done, like you, I've done a lot of stuff. I would say that the NA, the Narcotics Anonymous step guide, it's a book about this fucking thick, is the most profound thing you can ever do. Mm. It's fucking.
What's the spiritual journey?
It is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It is just, you know, when you do four, when you go into step four, and you go into sex inventory, you go into love inventory, you go into all your defects of character, you know, what you've done, and then you put that down on a piece of paper, you really see what your drivers are.
Mm.
And then going into, you know, 5, 6, 7, which is, you know, so we're getting past 3, which is God, and then you move in something bigger than me.
Higher power.
Mm. Yeah. And that I'm not the controller of my life, you know, and it's. You know, I think it's a double-edged sword, but it's for me, it's there are you. I mean, you definitely are the controller of your life, but it's that selfishness that it removes.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, it's surrender.
I'll tell you this, right? The only time I ever considered doing meth, right? Like, and this is I now look back on a God, like that there is a God. I've never ever considered it, even if I was at a party, right, and everyone was throwing it around. I would never do it. Ever. I wouldn't do it.
Did you have like a moral objection to it?
I just was like, no, I can't do it. Yeah, I just couldn't do it. Because I knew. I knew that
it would be a gateway for you.
Game over. Mm-hmm. So the only time I ever considered, I remember I was with my older brother and he had a meth problem. And he was coming out the back of it and he was sort of clean. He was, but he was patchy and now thankfully he doesn't do it anymore, and he hasn't done it for years. But we were in Darwin and we couldn't, and we used to go up there and party and do our thing. We couldn't get any more drugs, right? We couldn't get any more blow. We couldn't get any more pills, whatever. And he said, oh, but I can get, he calls it Bob, best of the best. I can get Bob. And I went, fuck it, do it. And he couldn't get it. And the guy was asleep and he left his phone on the thing. I know, but that to me was just like something moment, that yeah. night. Something said, hey, I got you, bro. And there's been several other little, you know, instances where, you know, you want to get into the God thing or higher power. Like if you think you're God, just go walk out into the ocean and try and stop the waves. Good luck, bro. Do you know what I mean? And so something for me, it's about really connecting to that.
Do you have a personal, do you see God as personal or impersonal?
Both.
Mm.
But that's also because I've done a lot of Vedic stuff too. So there's the Vedic, you know, I think that there's the Vedic sort of like, you know, natural law, nature, right?
But did you grow up in more of a Christian context?
Yeah, it was, I mean, Cranbrook, my parents are not, I don't think that there was any religion. I'm probably more religious now than I've ever been. I pray, you know, a lot. And Jay's had quite a big impact, you know, because he was an altar boy and my relationship with him, he very much, you know, wants me to, you know, be in touch with God. And that's also the 12-step thing, kind of going back there as well, trying to implement that in my life. But it's a humility thing for me.
Yeah.
And we got a bit off topic there, but like for me, it was a humility thing that coming into this stage, you know, of my life that I can't do and control everything, and that's okay.
Yeah, I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so when was it, you know, after you lost the money, you went sort of really off the rails, took that to the extreme, and then I'm assuming at some point in your kind of mid to late 20s, you went back to the 12 steps.
No, I hated them for years.
Or some form of rehab.
No, I met Nico, actually.
Okay, so you started meditating.
I learned to meditate, yeah.
And was that sort of serendipitous or were you actively seeking?
It was
sort of a meditation teacher or?
Well, I mean, you know, God bless him. I mean, my mother had actually said to me, there's this guy that you should go and see. His name's Tim Brown. And he's helping all these people and you should go and learn to meditate. And I sort of brushed it off or whatever. And I think I was at a point where, I mean, they talk about it, bring it to your knees. I mean, I'd lost everything. I'm not talking friends, everyone. I was like, fuck, what do I do?
Tim.
Everything. And I was actually working at Randwick Racecourse. Because the only thing,
as a bookie?
No, cleaning out stables.
Okay.
Because the only thing that I knew I could definitely do was ride. Like
back to your equestrian roots.
Yeah, well, it's the only thing I had.
Right.
I felt like I couldn't raise any more money. You know, I couldn't, what am I going to do? And so I learned to meditate and I was like.
So life really simplified for you.
Oh, bro. Like, I was all like, for like 3 or 4 years, or 2 years, it was like, I just had meditation. That was my thing. Which is interesting to fast forward to this year. And this is why I talk about identity so much, right? So I learned to meditate. I was very, very close with, you know, Nico and I became very, very close. And I dived in, right? Like, they started talking about God consciousness and all these, you know, terms that I would say that I didn't understand fully then. But I was like, God, I want that. Like, how can I get that? Because I wanted to, you know, because I wanted a family. Or I wanted to really turn my life around, right? And so I met Nico and he was like, mate, become a metronome, meditate. And that's what I did. And I just meditated and he was, I guess in absence of my father or even brother or friends, I was like, hey, like I'll do, if he said, go walk down the road naked with a book on your head, I would have done it. Like I was so willing to do anything to turn my life around.
Did you feel really lost?
I felt very scared, I think is a better term.
Like fear of God type scared.
Yeah, well, actually, no, that came sort of post 108, actually, but
dark night of the soul.
Yeah, fuck, bro. that was a very dark night of the soul. So so I walked, and it was I didn't feel lost, but in looking back on it, you know, I mean, I didn't know what to do. I mean, I remember going to apply to jobs at cafes, and like I couldn't get it. They'd be like, "Why the fuck are you here?" Like they'd be like, "What?" I couldn't. I mean, Lux in Malara. I used to go there for coffee every day. I was like, can I have a job? They're like, no, why are you here? What? So the only thing I had was writing. So I'd wake up at 2:30 in the morning. I'd work six horses in the morning from 2:30 to 8:30. I'd come home. I'd sleep from 8:30 till 12, and I'd be back at Randwick Racecourse at 1, and I'd clean out all the stables for 20. I think when I rode, I made $35 an hour or $35 a ride, and you know I made $25 an hour because I needed the money. And I was meditating and meditating and meditating. However, what I will say is that when all that shit went away, all the sort of finance stuff.
The finance identity.
Well, yeah. Well, no, just to even like, I mean, if you asked me what the price of oil was then, I was like, well, I don't know. Or even where the S&P was, I wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God, wow, this is like, life's actually kind of, it's all right. Right. Like it was a very simple time for me. A very, very beautifully, beautifully simple time. And I moved to the Central Coast, and that's where I met my ex-girlfriend. And she was a horse rider. And we had this, you know, that was a very, you know, it was a very sort of simple time, you know, in my life that I look back on. And Nico said it to me. I'll never forget it. Nico said, mate, you will look back on this and think it's one of the best times in your life. He said, I promise you. And he was right.
Mm.
That real simplicity of just driving to the Central Coast every day, riding eight horses, drinking a beer, coming home, having a burger, rinse, repeat. It was a very simple time. It was super cool. And then as things developed, you know, you start getting, it was like, then I think that you start going, well, fuck, is this it? Is this all my life's going to be?
How long did that take?
About 13 months.
And you were just getting itchy feet?
I don't think, I wouldn't say it was, itchy feet maybe is the wrong word. I wanted more.
That's what I would call it. Well, yeah.
Fine. I think I deserved more. I wanted more.
No, not necessarily just in relation, just with life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted more.
You didn't feel like you were growing.
Yeah. But looking back, I mean, I was doing so much work. Oh my God. I mean, I was meditating twice a day. I was rounding once a day. I was like in therapy. I was pulling everything.
What kind of therapy? Like just basic CBT therapy?
No, a lot of somatic stuff.
Okay.
So doing all that. Yeah, shadow work. I could write a book, like just doing all that sort of stuff. And, you know, not to sort of go there too much, but what came out of that actually was like Wanzerate to me, the reason why Wanzerate was birthed when I went to Nick and I said, I've got this idea in blockchain and crypto and sort of was because I wanted to help people not go through the pain that I went through to get to where I was. That's where the idea for Wanzerate came from. And the whole rewards mechanism was because if you could incentivize people to not, you know, to not
create a positive addiction.
Yeah. and if you can push them that way, you know, that would be really cool. And that was, you know, and credit to Nico at the time. I mean, he didn't know anything about it and he goes, bro, like I'm in, you know, and we went on that journey. But the big thing for me was when that ended, you know, which was in February. That was huge. That marks the most catastrophic, like that is the biggest pivotal moment of my entire life, period. Put through everything else I've been through.
Mm.
That was big.
And do you think it's because, you know, you came from this time where you had, you know, already gone through so much and you made sort of this conscious decision to change your life and you did that work and you, you know, earned relative amounts of inner peace, I'm assuming, through that process, or, you know, more than you had, or at least stability. And then from that new place that you had earned, emerged that business. And then in losing that, was it a feeling of, you know, injustice?
Yeah, I mean, yes, but I think it was more who the fuck am I without, you know, yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, not to sound too, but who am I without being A, Nico's business partner, and B, the co-founder of Wanzerate, and not being involved in, you know, the Vedic community? Like, who the fuck am I?
Because so it had become that much a part of
it. It was my, like, we'd almost become, I wouldn't say codependent, but like we would speak 50 times a day. Like it was my identity. It was me. So when we decided that I would exit, I was like, whoa, what the, who is this? And that was the first time that, you know, I mean, you talk about that's when booze went, like the dial.
Did you drink right during those years?
I did, and to give myself, and if I look back on it, like, you know, I mean, Nico would say certain things, and he was right. Like, was I as committed as I thought I was? Probably not. I was still, you know, hiding, still having a bit of an escape route. Do you know what I mean? You know, was I that? Mm. I had to be fucking stripped proper.
Yeah.
And really go into, I mean, you've spoken about it too, that real dark night of the soul.
Yeah, admitting it and facing yourself.
And who are you and what are you? Mm. Jesus. And that's when, that's when it got ugly. And then this is where the whole God thing came from. Life just kept like throwing these things at me. Like from what happened with Josh to like, it was all happening.
Mm.
And so to cope, it was, I mean, mate, I used to drink 3 bottles of wine a night and get up and go and train. It's insane. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
You know, so, but the idea behind that was like, I don't know who I, who the fuck am I?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sort of like lost in like, if I, whoa. And then actually what came out of it was, do I even have the energy? The energy
to do it again.
To
rebuild.
I don't. And for a long time, and I didn't.
Yeah. Well, that was the truth at the time.
And to be fair,
I mean, I think that's actually a really, you know, important message for the audience to really hear too. You know, when you're going through something like that, just because you don't have that energy, you know, immediately doesn't mean it won't return. And I think people are very like, you know, they lack a lot of self-compassion in those moments where it's like sometimes you just need to accept that depression for what it is.
Yeah, totally.
For as long as it takes to rest, yeah.
You know, I mean, my mother said it to me. I mean, you know, she did. She said, you know, this will pass, right? But you don't believe it.
No, of course. Right. And it feels like eternity.
Fuck me, dude. And it just kept coming and kept coming, all this stuff. Yeah. And then people would say stuff about me and it wasn't true. And I was just like, I can't, you know. And this is where, alcohol, you know, even look at alcohol, whatever, if you're that sort of, it is your best friend. It's your buddy, right? So there's a lot of grief in giving it up too. There's a lot of stuff that goes in it.
How am I going to cope?
Yeah. And what am I going to do? And this is why, you know, and it wasn't really until Jay and Simon, you know, until Jay and Simon, they were the first little, they were like the little white light that I started to like have a laugh again. And they were that little, for whatever reason, which is so odd. That was that little like, it's that gangster, like we got you bro mentality. It was that, that's what I got from that.
Mm.
That it was just that, you know, that we got you no matter what.
Have you felt in this, you know, chapter of your journey, do you feel like you've had an experience yet of feeling fully content within yourself and being your own person, regardless of who's around or what projects are going on?
Yeah, definitely. And I think I'm definitely there. Like, I know one thing that, you know, and you and I have often talked about this, but one thing that I do is I'm at a point now where I don't really give a fuck what people say about me. Like, I just don't care. Because I've spent so long caring, right? It's so fucking painful. It's too hard. So you get to a point where like, I know who I am. I know what I did. And I'm not saying that I did everything perfectly because
I
didn't.
Did you feel like you own yourself fully?
Yeah, now I'm pretty good. Maybe like we can always be better, but I just don't care. Do you know what I mean? I don't. That's where I've gotten to. And I like, you know, I love my little time. I love my time alone.
Is that new, being able to be with yourself?
No, definitely. I definitely enjoyed it more, but it was, yeah, it's definitely like what this process has done is that you really, when you go through that dark night of the soul and, you know, and that, all that, that experience with, you know, what happened with Josh and all these things, when you're left with zero, right, you know, you would, yeah, you know, you really do start to, and this is why we started with identity. It's not what do I do, but who actually am I? Like, if you ask yourself, like, who are you? What are the qualities that make up you? Not your hair color or your job, or are you kind?
How would you define your character in those ways?
Now?
Yeah.
I would say this is what I like about me, if I've decided to define myself. I love how generous I am, because I am generous, right? I become very real, right? Very, very, extremely, almost like, sometimes I even feel too real, right? I'm hardworking, right? I'm a bit of a larrikin, and I can be cheeky and cocky, and, you know, there's an ego part of me that I actually, you know, invite in that I enjoy, right? And you know, I love the sort of, I don't always do it. I don't get it right, but I love the sort of structured way of things. You know, I like that. I like order, actually, because disorder,
maybe sense.
Yeah. Sense. Totally. Because disorder and chaos, I can, that's very easy. In this period particularly, I mean, maybe my mother would disagree, but I don't speak a lot much anymore. I used to talk heaps. I used to always know everything and say everything and do everything. I've found solitude and gratitude in silence. And that's something that actually Jay's, you know, really tried to bang into me, or Jay and Simon have banged in really, really. It's like your words are much more powerful when you don't say them a lot.
Mm. When did you complete the 12th step? And we'll get to RPM soon on this note.
Well, I would say that I haven't done step 12 properly.
Okay.
Because step 12 is giving back to other alcoholics in a big way.
Mm.
And I would like to get there, but I would have it. And that's just me being honest with myself. And if you're still, and I drink still now and whatever, and it's a journey, it wouldn't feel right to me, you know, to go and take someone through the steps, because I'm not in the program, and I'm not, you know, doing that. I would feel like I'm doing it a disservice.
Mm.
Can I speak about my journey? And I also think there are other things, you know, I mean, I'm so busy at the moment, but something that I'm desperately want to get back to that really, really helps me is like sauna and ice bath, change the body.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I mean, if you, they say if you have a cold shower, right? So you've got to sign the science. A vape will increase dopamine in the brain by 1.5 times.
Yeah, ice baths are the best.
Right, cocaine, 2 times.
It's like 500x.
Yeah, well, yeah, with nicotine though. So seriously. So, but the difference is that then the dopamine drops off, blah, 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 blah. Everyone knows this research, right? Ice bath dopamine keeps rising. So there are other ways to me that, you know, I'm also kind of just like, I've also made peace with that it's my journey, and I'm doing it the way that I want to do it, and that's okay. Do you know what I mean? Where before so much it was like, fuck, I'm so ashamed because I've relapsed, or I've picked up a drink, or I've done this, or maybe, well, that's cool too, bro. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
I'm just okay with, I'm just doing it my way, and I don't need anyone else but me to like it
What is integrity? How would you define integrity?
Oh, big question. I think integrity is doing the right thing even when it's difficult. Particularly,
how do you define the right thing?
I don't know how to define it. What is right? I don't know. I mean, the right thing
based on your values.
Yeah, I think so. It's hard to, you know, hard to define. And I think that, you know, this is so, it's so interesting. I was talking to this, you know, about it the other day. It's like that whole, I mean, you know, this with your father, that whole world, right? That sort of gangster world, right? There's a sort of code. There's a code of honor there. I find them easier to deal with sometimes than inverted commas normies, because there's this sort of code of honor that and Jay was saying it the other day. He's like, bro, the only thing I have when you've been to prison or you've run bike clubs.
Your word's your word.
It's the only thing I've got.
Yeah.
And mine was fucking useless.
Mm.
It's something that I will not do anymore.
Because you weren't able to follow through, you let people down a lot, you lied.
I lied. I it was always from a good place, right? Mm. I lied to buy time or because I didn't want to hurt people or whatever it was. I mean, I never did it because I wanted to rip someone or I wanted to.
Yeah, you're disowning yourself.
Yeah. But in actual fact, it's better just go bang, shotgun in the head. This is it. Sorry if I can deal with it. Yeah. Right. And I was lying to myself.
Well, that's always where it comes from.
And that's it. Like, you know, if you're not doing something, right? If you're not doing something, you don't know it. You understand it. Do you get my point?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
So I could fucking tell you anything about anything, right?
Mm.
But if you're not doing it, but I wasn't doing it.
Mm.
And in actual fact, to give you know Nico credit where it's due, he's like, mate, you got to live it. Now, yeah. I don't agree with everything that Nico does, and it's his life and his journey, and I don't want to. I'm not saying that I'm talking about that, but one thing I know for sure is that you know, I mean, he anything that he said he was doing around you know as a meditation teacher, he does that, man. He does that period, and there were times in my life where I wasn't living everything that I was saying.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
And you feel like you've cleaned that up?
No, I mean, of course we all have work still to be done, but for the most part, I just
the reason I ask is I think that that's actually quite a rare journey. You know, I've interviewed a lot of people, I've met a lot of people, and you know, grappled with the question about humanity: do people really change? You know, fundamentally, do they really change? I believe that they do. I've changed.
I've deeply
changed, and I know that that's possible. And I like to hold that beacon of hope for others. You know, if you warden enough, and you're sincere, and you're humble, and you're hardworking,
yep.
You can change your life, and that's you know available to anyone. It doesn't discriminate.
Well, I know there's someone very close to you that happened to.
Yeah, I've seen that miracle work in you know more than one person's life. But I would say you know. It is kind of a 1 in 1,000 situation, unfortunately, because a lot of people do have to hit that absolute, you know, whatever that hell is for you or otherwise defined as the rock bottom. But we've talked about this. Like I've been to hell. You say you've been to hell. This is a place it is a state of consciousness that feels eternal in its expression. And I think, you know, this is where the only way out is faith.
Well, there's an interesting book. It's called
Inferno.
That's good too. It's called Finding Wattiko.
Mm.
So Wattiko is the ancient indigenous term, right, for evil.
Mm.
It operates on a plane.
Oh, it's a realm.
Yeah,
it's a realm. Yeah,
you know, you've been there.
But this is yeah. Oh, yeah. And the. You know the thing about it is it's so deceptive and tricky by nature.
Yep.
It's like that fable, which is you know heaven is where this beautiful table is set, and everyone's picking up their forks to feed each other, and hell is where this amazing banquet and table is set. In some ways, even potentially more elaborate than heaven, but you go to pick up the fork and the fork, and as you feed yourself, the fork starts to mutate and melt and you just can't, you can't enjoy what's right in front of you. Yep. And I think that this is why hell is self-imposed. We do it to ourselves.
I think it's just, and it's a place far from God.
Well, it's your own shame and guilt that puts you there.
Yeah, it's huge.
And the way through that, as you know, can feel so incredibly overwhelming that finding and cultivating the strength to just take that first step, I think is, you know, the thing that is so overwhelming because people are thinking, you know, how do I get to the top of that Mount Everest? And I want to talk about sort of your journey in RPM soon, that the journey to the top of the tip of Mount Everest is so far that I can't take the first step. They just let, you know, the enormity of what that would actually take to change their life kind of prevent them from taking that first step. And so I guess my question in that as it relates to your journey now is what would these first steps out of that hell? And I think your journey with building RPM is such a, you know, I hope that acts as a light for someone that's listening to this. It's maybe, you know, not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, I think it was sort of too. Look, I'm definitely still dealing with stuff, you know, professionally, you know, that are, I guess, still hanging in the wind or that are unsolved. But for me, it was, you know, it was. I mean, RPM came first, and I don't think RPM pulled me out until RPM sort of pulled me out a bit later. But the idea behind RPM came, you know, it was clear that my time at 108 was over, in a lot of ways, and I didn't want to go back. actually, if I was honest, if I got asked to, I thought I really wanted them to ask me back. And then I got to a place where I was like, I don't want to go back. I don't, it's not my place anymore. I'd come through that.
Yeah, the pain changes you. Yeah. You become someone different.
And it also, and what they're building, I think, is fantastic, by the way. I mean, I think it's a huge, big goal. I think, you know, from what I understand of it, I'm not involved at all. I don't hear anything. I don't really know, but from pieces, from what I've seen, I guess, on their website, so I think it's unreal. But it's not, it changed, and it wasn't, it's not me anymore. You know what I mean? And so RPM just became, because I was like, look, I love DeFi, I love blockchain, and I fucking love cars. Well, how can I?
We didn't even talk about that. When did you start driving in amongst all of this?
Probably in like 21, 22.
Okay, so it was recent.
Yeah, but cars have been, ask my mother. Sure. Jesus.
They're actually like racing.
Getting involved in the motorsport community properly was quite a recent thing.
Okay.
And so, So I love blockchain. I love DeFi and I love cars. And I say this a lot. Someone said to me, oh, God, I wish I could, $10, he puts it into the wall at turn one. I just had this big aha moment and I went home and, built out RPM over a weekend, basically, you know, which is, you know, it's sort of, you know, content creation, prediction markets, right? And motorsport. That's RPM is the intersection of those things. So I did that, but to answer your question, what pulled out of it was like, you know, just, it was Jane Simon. It was Simon's humor. He's, you've met him and you've spoken. Fuck, he's funny. And Jay's like absurdly like fucking frankness. Like, you know, when he's on, I mean, he was on the podcast. Yeah. 10 years in prison. Yeah. Quick 10. Man.
That's what we chose as the caption.
Yeah.
Quick 10.
Like, and he's been fucking for real.
Mm.
Right. And he's sort of like, come on, bro, get over it. Oh, yep. All good, bro. Like it was that. So it was the combination of that, that just over time, it was changing and things were changing. And I felt, you know, and other personal relationships and, you know, I mean, even our relationship, right, growing as a result of that, right? Or you know, or relationships at home or whatever it is, it was just slowly I didn't feel that I had to be alone and that all this stuff that was going on outside, as hectic as it was, it was like, you know, it was going to be okay.
Mm.
And it's... And that was sort of the first, and it's like, you know, it was that, you know, that's why I think young men like, that's why I think bike clubs are so attractive, because it's brotherhood. There's not much of it really around.
Mm. I mean, what are your general reflections? Because so much of your journey, you know, just listening to you has been shaped by sort of wanting to find that sense of place and that sense of belonging. What are your general kind of reflections on how we operate today as a society?
Oh man, we don't need another 10 podcasts.
Not to open Christ. Up another 2 hours of conversation.
Yeah. That's huge. I think we're operating at two extremes. I think, you know, I think we're not operating in the middle. I think the whole leftism woke, you know, I think we've lost truth.
Hmm.
That's
or truth has just become this sort of, well, truth has become subjective. Yeah.
Yeah. Truth has become a subjective narrative. It's not what is true. It's what is true to me.
Yeah.
You know, truth is something that doesn't change.
True, because I say it is, yeah.
Yeah. Like, if
it's
I want to
be... very interesting being the founder of In Truth.
Isn't it?
In today's...
Yes, it would be. It would be very, very interesting.
In today's world, yeah.
So I think that truth is like, you know, and that filters into my journey around, you know, heaps of stuff. It's like, you know, it's just, you know, it doesn't change. And this is what happened. And think what you want, but...
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, to me, if I was to sum up kind of how, you know, you've fully overcome an addiction and sort of any difficult time, not even just addiction, but a difficult time in your life, is to be able to look it fully in the eyes and see it for what it is and to not run away.
Yeah, 100%. And I think to circle back to your about the identity of whether, you know, people identify as an addict and they're 20 years clean. Like, I mean, there is, I won't say her name because it's an anonymous program, but there is a woman who runs the Bondi Beach AA, right? And she's 11 years sober. She goes there every morning at 7:30 and sets it up.
Hmm.
So I find, you know, and there's another guy I know who smokes, you know, he shares and then he'll run out and he has to smoke a cigarette because it like overwhelms him. But, you know, he's 25 years sober. He goes there every morning. Now, maybe that, I mean, the big driver of that, you know, for these two people who I know is that it's so that they can help others. That's doing 12.
Hmm.
Right? That is doing step 12.
Yeah.
You know, there's another guy I know who's, you know, who shares his story around his daughter was killed in the Bali bombings.
Wow.
And he was 2 years sober. He didn't pick up a drink.
Mm.
And he comes and he reads the last card that she ever wrote him. Mm. He didn't pick up a drink or a drug.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, they identify as that, you know, really that is the place that, you know, that maybe I get to, or I hope we all get to, where it's that level of humility is so powerful to me.
Yeah, well, when life has humbled you that much and you can actually receive that and let it shape you.
But I get what you're also saying in terms of identity, like, okay, well, I no longer identify as being one, therefore, you know, therefore I'm not, and that definitely changes. I do understand that.
I actually see the journey as more integration. It's to understand that we're all things.
Yeah.
But maybe at a certain point, you know, we can allow different pieces of ourselves to come to the forefront as more dominant parts of our identity, but never to disown, you know, even if it was a part of you that hasn't expressed itself for many decades, it's still a part of you.
Yeah. But it's, and I wouldn't, would I change it? I mean, maybe parts of it, but probably not, you know, looking back, if I'm, you know, really honest, I wouldn't change it.
What about if 27-year-old BJ was sitting here in my chair? What would you say to him?
I think there's a part of me that would say, hey, go to uni and, you know, do the right
27.
Yeah, I think.
Go back to uni, study.
I did, actually.
Okay.
I've been to uni like 6 times.
It's never too late.
Right. There's this thing called ADD. I don't know if you've heard of it, but everyone's self-diagnosing with it.
If everyone has something, then no one has it.
I think I say that.
That's going to trigger all my audience.
Yeah, I say that because I'm intrigued at what would have been, I guess.
Mm.
But I also know, but I'm also at peace that wasn't.
What about life advice? Like your character? Based on where you're sitting today.
If 27-year-old BJ was
here. I'm choosing that year because you said it was the sort of the worst year in your out of control behavior, other than 6 months ago. Maybe that's a bit too fresh. We'll go back.
No, I'm happy to talk about decade, that. No. What would I say? I'd be like, it's all going to be all right, bro.
Just relax.
Yeah. It's all good.
And do you feel like that's what you've found is through all of this? Could you kind of summarize it by feeling like you're more able to relax into life and kind of trust?
I think I got some hectic shit going on, but like, I think so. Yeah. And I think what I would say to him was like, it's all going to be okay. Just slow down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just chill.
Mm.
You don't have to do everything and be everything all at once. You know, just.
You've got time?
You got time.
Hmm.
I think, and you know, I mean, there's an investor that's investing inside RPM. I mean, he's, I think, 65 or something. I mean, he just went back to Harvard.
Yeah, so great.
So it's like, you know, fortunately, I mean, that was, but you know, back then, like back in, we're talking, you know, early 2000s, you know, it was all around. I mean, if you didn't have a degree, no one to look at you. Do you know what I mean? That was sort of the craze back then. You know, that was.
If you look at all the great entrepreneurs, none of them.
Well, it's funny you say this because I actually think to myself, would I push my kids to go to uni?
Not a chance.
I don't think so.
No way.
And I'm starting to understand sort of homeschooling, and it's very different. Like, I mean, the schools, it's like they're indoctrinating. I mean, that's a whole other podcast, but. Yeah. This, you know,
that's not what the education system is going to look like in 10 years.
No, but if I look, I think for me, it's to go back to him. It was like find true brotherhood, you know, right, it's going to be okay. And you don't have to be all these things that you think you have to be. Just try and work out who you actually are.
Mm. Do you want to give a sort of a spiel about what RPM is? I can't say that I know many of my audiences to be motorsports fans, but
many of them
love decentralization.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Well, no, RPM's just, it's, look, you know, I mean, we're speaking for a lot and the podcast went in a different direction, which is fine, and we can talk about RPM later, but it's just a new decentralized motorsport exchange. That's what it is.
Mm.
So RPM brings content creators, motorsport, and blockchain together through prediction markets where you can predict on any real race event and or outcome throughout the world, and you can trade those prediction-like shares. So will Max Verstappen win the Drivers' Championship this year? You can put that up. You can buy that at 10 cents, and you can sell it at a dollar. It always settles at a dollar. We then have car clubs inside RPM where you can create your own garage and you can collect digital twins of cars and car parts. So we sort of marry that into, you know, into the prediction markets. And, you know, we're not a gambling site. We're not bookies. That's not our revenue model. Our revenue model is that we're like a Hyperliquid or a Pump.Fun, where we provide the infra or the infrastructure and the technology for content creators to really monetize their knowledge, right, inside motorsport. That's what RPM is. So yeah, it's very BJ.
And then, well, it's a great place to land after this really long journey, which I appreciate you sharing so honestly and vulnerably as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. What about the next, 5-10 years?
I think it's why I'm getting older. I know. I feel maybe because I'm not getting older. I've lived a lot of life.
Yeah.
So I think it's
two very different things.
No, I think Dubai. I think it's clear that, you know, for me, it's about obviously really, it's about doing this the way that, you know, that I want to do it. This being RPM, I mean, I have a fantastic team that and I said this in my other podcast, like, I'm just a fucking chef, bro. Like, I've literally just got better people than me and put them in a room and, you know, and try to support them, bring, you know, their best talents to come to the forefront, you know, to help what is this thing that we call RPM.
Mm.
So I think it's really scaling that, you know, we're, you know, looking very heavily at sponsoring an F1 team.
That's cool.
Yeah, that'll be cool. And you know, making this sort of, I guess, my legacy, this being RPM. And then that's into family and, you know, kids. I'm not in a rush to have kids, mainly because there's a lot of stuff.
Some work to do still.
My mother will kill me. I did toy with the idea for about a month that I didn't want children. That did come into my.
I don't believe that.
No, that's not true. But it's just doing this the way that I want to do it, and this is my legacy, and then seeing where it goes. You know, Dubai is a big part of the horizon. I think that, you know,
you're gonna love it.
Yeah,
it's an absolute mecca.
Yeah, I'm very excited that we're doing a lot there with a lot, you know, some key influential people there in motorsport, and I can't say much about that yet, but I will. And like, that's super cool. And just, it feels, you know, it feels, this feels a bit different.
Mm.
It just feels a bit different. You know, it just feels like this is, I say this with gratitude and with humility, this is maybe finally my time.
Mm.
And I don't say that like, as in like, cause I'm going to become a billionaire. Like, it's just, I kind of get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
You get life enough.
I get why I had to go through what I went through. I get it. I get it. In a very weird way, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very weird way, I'm quite grateful for it. And it's very humbling. And I love my crew. Like, I do. I love the people that I speak to every day. I love my team. I love, you know, I really love what I do. And through all the shit, you know.
Mm.
I really, really like, and I love what I do. And I said this on my last podcast, it's a privilege that I get to work with these people who have got my back and I've got theirs, and I've got amazing friends and personal relationships now in my life. You know, you and I speak all the time, of which you're one of them. Excited to see what we can do together. I should probably see my mother more, which I will. But it's you know, there's so much, there's so much that has happened in the last 18 months. But it's, I sort of look at it all and I can understand God's plan and I'm grateful that it has. And this feels like a cool, it's going to be a ride.
A good chapter.
I think so.
Yeah. BJ, how do these guys support you, get in touch? We'll obviously put all of your social media links below.
Sure.
Is there any particular CTA that you'd like to plug whilst you have the...
CTA meaning what?
Call to action.
Oh, call to action, right. Sorry, I was thinking about something else. No, if you're, this is something that I guess very important to me. If you are listening to this and you are struggling with addiction, just please know that you're not alone. That is the only thing that I will say. And my Instagram will be on there. There's, you know, if you are in Australia, give us a call. Like, you're not, it's...
Be careful.
Yeah. But yeah, just know that you're not alone and you know, there's always someone that wants to help you and you don't have to sit in that, you know, in that dread, like I did for so long, and, just know it's going to be okay. And all of you, if I have to plug, just put up lots of predictions on RPM.
Yeah.
So we can all make lots of money.
Thank you, BJ.
Thank you, Nick.